Welcome to Uncle Nene's Nerdcast. I'm your host, Nathan Fletcher, a.k.a. Uncle Nene. We have a great show for you today. We have a really unique guest with an incredible background. He has written very successful books. He is a serial entrepreneur, a physicist, an engineer. He has more degrees than a thermostat. He has an incredible background. Award-winning author, his Tachyon Tunnel sci-fi series launches readers through time and space, blending hard science with big adventure. He has science fiction fantasy storytelling rooted in science, innovation, and big ideas. We have a really special guest for us. Welcome to the show, Michael Gordon.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. It's an honor to be here.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you coming by. I guess, you know, my first question is, you know, you have really interesting background, not something we see in a lot of authors, award-winning authors. So you had a tech entrepreneur start, engineer start. So I'd love to know kind of what led from that journey to writing.
I think, you know, when I was in elementary school, I wrote a book and the librarian said, oh, this is really great. We're going to print it and put it in our library. So the bug started very, very early. But then I became an engineer and worked as an engineer. And what I realized is be successful in business, have to be a great storyteller. And the better the stories, the more you engage with the people around you, whether they're colleagues or mentors or whatever. So you just, it's sort of survival of the fittest. The best storyteller wins.
That's so true. Very true. Yeah, I read that at 12, you wanted to be the first man on Mars. Is that accurate?
Yeah. I was I was in the Philippines. My dad was an Air Force sergeant. We watched Neil and Buzz walk on the moon. And I thought, man, I want to do that. And I was in the Boy Scouts at the time. My Boy Scout leader was an Air Force Academy graduate, C-130 pilot, and he pulled out a sheet of paper and he said, here's the things you need to do. And all those degrees, they were part of that dream.
Wow. Wow. That's neat. That's incredible. Well, you know, it may happen. A man on Mars may happen, you know, fairly soon. So we may see that actually come to reality.
It will, but not when we're young enough to go.
Right. Right. Absolutely. So, you know, I was thinking about, you know, the I'm intrigued by the fact that you know, quietly wrote your first few novels just for fun, intended only for friends and family. It wasn't until your fourth novel, Four Fathers and Founding Fathers, which ended up hitting number one on Amazon's historical fiction chart. So, you know, what changed for you at that point, you know, where, you know, you're writing for friends and family, then all of a sudden you've got this hit on your hands.
Well, Forefathers and Founding Fathers was a project I wanted to do with my daughter. And the reason why I wanted to do it with my daughter was when I was growing up, my dad said we had a forefather who was always in trouble in the early colonies. And Elena, my daughter, and I started doing the research and we realized that yes, he was always in trouble, but because in the 1630s, he believed in equal rights for women, he thought we should treat the Native Americans with respect and learn their languages and their cultures. And so, you know, he was beaten on the square. And
this is someone that is actually related to you.
Yeah, his name is Samuel Gorton, same last name. And I can trace the lineage. I know the name of every father, grandfather, all the way back to Samuel. Anyway, so I started doing the research and I realized that he was one of the co-founders of the Rhode Island colony. So how did it become a number one? I thought every single person with the last name Gorton probably wants to know this story. So I started reaching out on social media. A bunch of people bought it and it became number one. It really was not intended to do anything more than that. But then Brown Books picked up the book and they published it and got it into libraries around the country. But that happy ending did not end happily because Brown wanted me to go on a book signing tour where I'd go to all the little bookstores around the country. And I didn't want to do that. I'm an entrepreneur. I want to build companies.
Yeah.
And so I passed on that opportunity, which did not endear me to my publisher.
That's interesting. If I could dig in just a little bit on that story, you know, I'm always fascinated by how we view our ancestors and our lineage. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't have any role in the decisions they made, but yet we do take some kind of connection to it, whether it be, I'm a little ashamed of this ancestor of mine. What was it like to find out that one of yours was probably in the 0.001 percentile of having that perspective, being so ahead of their times when it comes to human rights and civil rights, things like that? Because most of our ancestors were on the other side of the spectrum, right? So, you know, what did it do? I'm just curious for you and your daughter to discover that, you know, I mean, how did that, you know, kind of affect you? I'm curious.
Yeah, I think in a really positive way, Nathan, because I grew up a sergeant's kid. It means my dad didn't have a college degree. When we were traveling around in the Air Force, we lived in the poor side of the bases, if we got to live on base at all. And so that was my perspective of who I was and where I came from. And it all changed when I realized that my forefather was stood up for something a long time ago, was publicly kicked out of the Boston colony and started the Rhode Island colony, worked with some of the most famous people in the early colonies to establish a lineage. And then as I did the research a little bit farther, I realized that Samuel Gorton, that was my 16th forefather, had a great-grandson named Nathaniel Green, also from that same colony in Rhode Island. And for the history buffs out there, Nathaniel Green is the guy who George Washington sent to the South. We were getting our butts kicked by Cornwallis in the South, and he needed somebody who was a real scrapper. And Nathaniel Green went down and kicked butt, never won a battle, but decimated the British Army by hitting and running, hitting and running, hitting and running,
right,
all the way
to
Yorktown, yeah, where Washington was waiting for him. And the war ended in Yorktown.
Fascinating. That's incredible. Wow. I love that story. Thanks for sharing that. So, you know, you've often praised infusing real science into science fiction. You've been mm-hmm. praised for doing that. I think that's I love that part of science fiction when people take the time to do that in the cinema world. I think of Interstellar being a great example of that. You know, how does your tech and science background shape the way you write sci-fi?
Well, I feel sorry for my wife because if we go to a science fiction movie, I'm always the critic.
Oh, no.
And, you know, something happens and I just think, that's not even possible. It doesn't, they just completely broke all the laws of physics. But I got to thinking about a decade ago, as the guy who wanted to be the first person on Mars, when we actually do start traveling in space, the possibility of even going to Alpha Centauri is almost impossible. The laws of relativity say it takes more and more energy to get to the speed of light, and you just can't do it. We had to find another way. And there's a theoretical particle called tachyons.
Okay.
That if you research them, the scientists sort of in tongue-in-cheek say they go faster than light, which means in the laws of relativity that they coexist before they exist. So everything that goes faster than light moves backwards in time. So that means a tachyon particle, if it's moving backwards in time, then it when it pops into existence, it actually dies before it was born. And that's why they sort of say that tongue-in-cheek, it coexists. But the reality is, as humans, we think of space as this three-dimensional structure, and it's not.
Right.
Space is space and time actually has a couple of dimensions. And we are not going to be traveling to Alpha Centauri by going through a black hole. That's a pepper grinder that would grind us up to nothingness, and a lot of science fiction does that. We don't really understand what Roddenberry was talking about when he says warp speed, but moving out of our three-dimensional space and into another component of the mathematical structure of space and traveling from point to point that way, that's how we're going to travel around the galaxy. So that's part one. And you know, tachyons were the beginning of it. But there's something even bigger and more fascinating that's happening. And when I was a grad student, my research project was plasma. And essentially what I was doing was looking at the solar wind as it hits the magnetic field of the Earth and building a computer model to show what it looked like. As a graduate student, it was all math. It was Fortran programming, Pascal to draw the graphics, and mathematics.
right.
Adhering to the laws of physics. That's what I thought of as plasmas. And over the last 15 years or so, we've come to realize that the entire universe is plasma. The stars are plasma. There are clouds that are in gravitational stability areas around the Earth called the Lagrangian points, and huge clouds of plasma in the Lagrangian points. And of course, the Earth's magnetic field that I built a computer model to shape is plasma. So that all sounds like a lot of really arcane science, but let me now turn it into something that's really cool. And that is, we're beginning to realize that plasma can self-organize, which means it's potentially a life form. And if it's a life form, now think really big, because the entire universe is plasma. Everything is plasma. And we live on these little specks of dust that we call planets. And we are organic life forms that, if we're lucky, we live 100 years. Plasma doesn't stop. It lives forever. And so that's kind of the big picture. Tachyon Tunnel 2 starts touching that. And 3, which we'll release in October, really expands on it. But let me take it back to Earth for just a second, because we're always pointing our telescopes, the radio telescopes and optical telescopes, up into space and going, is there life out there? There's got to be life. The universe is so big, there's got to be life. And I, for one, believe there is. I believe there are other organic, intelligent people like us out there. But I think we're thinking about it wrong. The real life in the universe is probably plasma. And there's a really great story, not fiction, but fact, of a lightning ball, which is plasma, entering an airplane and moving down the aisle. Specifically, okay, first of all, the airplane was not sitting on the ground. It was flying 500 plus miles an hour. The ball lightning enters the airplane and moves down the aisle. And all the passengers have reported on this, and some have taken pictures and videos, but it stops in certain places and then moves on and then departs the aircraft. How did that happen? How do you explain that without assuming there's some kind of intelligence there? And there are lots and lots and lots of stories. And I think science is just beginning to realize potentially that plasma is a life form. And if it is, and if it can self-organize, and if it is the entire universe, there's a lot of neurons that can make very, very complicated decisions, far more complicated than what we can.
That's incredible. Let me ask you this. When you consider all of the new information that the government is finally acknowledging when it comes to UAPs, UFOs, and the programs that they've had, and all the video and other evidence of these objects that definitely break the known laws of physics, like thermodynamics, they should be giving off a heat pattern for moving that fast, and they're not for some reason, and things like that. What are your thoughts? I didn't even go to college. You're a scientist. I'm curious what your thoughts are when you see all this information and you're observing the actual science in it. And what do you think? There's, you know, is it evidence that we're being visited by intelligent life from another planet or another solar system? Or is it maybe just the government making stuff?
Let's just roll the clock back 200 years and say that we're going to find somebody on the street and say, okay, we're going to bring you to the year 2025.
Right.
And they're going to be sitting beside you, and you're going to say, now I'm going to do this magic thing. There's this guy named Michael who's in another city, and we're going to start talking. There's going to be video. And the point that I'm making here is, in 200 years, think about what we've done in 200 years. We've gone from not even really well-greased axles traveling west to flying to the moon and having a probe leave the solar system. Here's a really kind of fun story. So behind me, you'll see right up here is Buzz Aldrin.
Yes.
One of the companies that I built was called Teladoc. And during the time I was building Teladoc, I became pretty good friends with Buzz Aldrin. And he told me something one time that startled me. He said, Michael, do you know who we had dinner with two nights before we headed for the moon? And so that would be Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, Mike Collins, right? And I went, well, who did you have dinner with? And he said, you remember the name of the guy who was the first to fly an airplane across the Atlantic. And I went, yeah, Charles Lindbergh. And I started thinking about it for just a second. I went, wait, before you went to the moon, you had dinner with Charles Lindbergh? And he said, yes, we did.
Wow.
So think about that. I mean, yeah. It's theoretically possible that Buzz Aldrin could have been friends with the Wright brothers.
Right.
So things happen really fast. And going back to our character that we pull off the street and the kids, they could never even remotely imagine the cool right. stuff that
we
you
would
and
be
I
wizards and witches to them. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's 200 years. Okay. Right. Now let's think about the age of our galaxy. It's in the teen billions. You could debate right. whether it's 16 billion or 12 billion, but it's
right.
But and the Earth is 4 billion years old.
Right.
4 billion years. And you have to see the number of zeros to understand this. But when we start thinking about what has humanity done in the last 100 years or 200 years,
right.
that's just 200 years.
Yeah.
I mean, what if we keep going at this rate, what are we going to be able to do 100 years from now, 1,000 years from now, 10,000 years from now, 100,000? And so now you have to start thinking really big, because think of what we've done in the last 100 years.
Yeah.
1,000,000 years from now. Well, 1,000,000 is still 1,000th of 1,000,000,000.
Right.
And this planet has been here for 4 billion years. So if there's another planet out there whose life formed 1,000 years before us, if they're
right.
1,000 years ahead of us,
right.
what have they got?
Right.
Who
They've
knows?
Already figured out, I mean, faster than light travel. I mean, at right. Yeah.
A couple of nights ago when I was at the steakhouse, there could have been one sitting right across from me looking just like a human enjoying dinner, because
right.
they came to the Earth for the Saltgrass Steakhouse prime rib.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's fascinating. You know, a big theme in your work is the future of humanity, technology, place and space. Your characters, for instance, in Tachyon Tunnel, your characters literally rewrite fate by leaping through a space-time tunnel.
Yeah.
And in the sequel, they face the Daklan Empire, an ancient civilization that has never been defeated in 50 million years. So
right.
my question, this scenario kind of sparks a lot of questions, but the first one is, what ideas about the future of humanity and technology are you really exploring in these stories? And is any real world examples you can point to that kind of triggered this, you know, storyline or beat or anything like that?
Sure. Well, first of all, when I wrote Tachyon Tunnel, it was I had just left the CEO slot of a company that I had built that changed everything in healthcare. And I wanted to do something fun. People started reading it and saying, wow, it could be way bigger than this. And so for the first time in all of the books that I've written, when I wrote Tachyon Tunnel 2, I said, I want to take everything I've learned as an engineer, a physicist, an entrepreneur, and everything I've read from, you know, Asimov's Foundation to Heinlein's yeah. Time Enough for Love to Weir's Mars Story to, and some of the more modern stuff, tie it all together in one really big story that's kind of like the Lord of the Rings, you know, where the hobbits go out and
yeah.
and what I realized is, again, humanity and organic life is a speck compared to the bigger universe. And we all think we're so important, but humanity still has all of the flaws that we had 4,000 years ago.
Mm.
And if the Daklans are humans like us, they're going to have the same flaws. They're going to want their power. They're going to want to keep their power, and they're
yep.
going to do everything they can to keep
yep.
it. You know, can that be defeated? Nobody is big enough to defeat it. But then we go back to the science for just a second, and we say, what happens if we try to change the timeline? So people speculate on this all the time, and that's all I'm doing. I'm taking speculation, but I'm applying the fundamental laws of physics. And one thing that we know is that everything has inertia. And so if we try and change something, then we have to deal with inertia. And so I'm speculating that if we try to change something on the timeline, we have an implication that is inertia. So for people that want a sort of a picture of that, imagine
right.
there was a show, a movie about a guy called Indiana Jones. And we can all picture Indiana Jones running through this sort of gutter, and there's a giant boulder rolling right behind
yep.
it.
Absolutely.
And You know, so if you want to understand inertia, think about two things. One, think about how fast was that boulder rolling? Not very fast. He was staying ahead of it, just running, right? And so if it had been a golf ball moving that speed, he would have just put his hand out and catch it. Or a bullet, he would have swatted it away because he would have seen it coming and swatted it. But because it's got so much mass moving at that speed, if it hits him, it's going to crush him. That's inertia. How much mass and how fast is it going? That's what makes him inertia. So little tiny bullet, little tiny fly, swat it out of the way. Giant boulder like that, swat it and you're going to get crushed.
Right.
So everything.
And you're applying physics, that to time.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
I'm saying
yeah.
that time has a ripple that. Effect.
Yeah. Right.
And if we change things, how does it impact?
How
and
big
so that's
is it?
One of the
right, yeah.
Yeah. It's one of the things that we will probably have to understand really well when we get to the point where we can travel through time. And my understanding of the multiple dimensions of physics, I firmly believe ultimately we will figure out how to travel through time.
That's fascinating. What do you hope people take away about our real future after reading your speculative fiction? Are you writing cautionary tales, inspirational ones, a bit of both?
Yeah, I'm an entrepreneur. And okay. Another name for entrepreneur is risk taker, right?
Yes.
And so I don't really live in the world of cautionary tales.
Okay.
To me it's entertainment, it's adventure, and then buried beneath the surface for those who want to embark and understand it, it is real science based on what I learned as a graduate student, what I learned as an engineering student, and what I've read.
That's fascinating. Let's talk about influences and comparisons. You blend a lot of hard science as well as deep emotion and romance. Mm-hmm. There's a dose of fantasy and some wonder in there. If you had to place your storytelling on the sci-fi fantasy spectrum, what other works or creators would you compare it to? I know that's a hard question, but
yeah, it really is. I like Asimov, but I don't think he does the human interactions that well. I like Heinlein because he does the human interactions really well. But you know, there are so many more in Tachyon Tunnel. I have a lot from early Spain, and I bring in The Man of La Mancha and those pieces because to me they're inspirational.
Yeah.
And I write a lot, Nathan. And whenever I write, I recognize that one of my jobs as a thought leader is to constantly try and inspire, because you never know when you're going to drop a seed or light a spark that turns it into something great. And I recognize that Neil and Buzz did that for me. And lots of other people along the way have done it for me. They've done it for you.
Yeah.
And something sparked that inspired us. And that spark, I think you do this podcast probably for that same reason. You know, how do we touch these people and create the continued momentum and acceleration.
That's great. I'm curious, when you are writing something that is like deep love, loss, in those kind of personal stakes, do you look at your own life in any way and get inspiration from when you have experienced that? Is it impossible for you to not think of those things and relive those experiences?
Well, there's a lot of it, but in order to say yes and have it be a complete answer, you also have to take into account the books we've read, the other people we've met, the stories we've heard along the way. And I think you tie all of those into, and I'll have friends come up to me all the time and say, you know, I think your character, Megan, is actually this person. A little bit, yes. And that's one of the things I think that I've learned how to do over the last few years, because in the beginning it was storytelling. And then I realized that I'm creating characters and the characters have to be consistent. And I did a lot better in Tachyon Tunnel 2 than I did in Tachyon Tunnel 1, because now I feel I'm not just writing for fun now. I feel like I'm writing something that can inspire and be transformational and be big. You know, I'm not just writing a story. When we started Teladoc, I didn't realize how big it was going to be. And it grew into what, a $500 billion industry. Everybody knows what telemedicine is now. And, you know, when Dr. Brooks and I started it, I never would have guessed we could do that. But now that we've done it, I think, okay, how do we do this again? You know, what's the process in writing a book to accomplish that same kind of a...
That's interesting. You mentioned Teladoc. Now, I read that you brainstormed Teladoc while climbing Mount Kilimanjaro.
Yeah.
You know, what... Tell me a little bit about that experience. I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah. The Kilimanjaro, because when I was young and my dad was a sergeant in the early 60s, he was tasked... He was a communications expert, but he was also a grunt. So there was this new thing called NASA that needed communication. So if they were going to send something into space, how were they going to communicate with it when it was over Africa or over Australia? And so the Air Force sent these grunts around the world to build stations. And one of the places my dad went was Kilimanjaro.
Fascinating.
It's such a cool sounding word, Kilimanjaro, that when I was in high school and reading books, I read a book called The Snows of Kilimanjaro, which was, you know, I love the author, but it was a really difficult book to read. But there was a magic. That word had a little bit of magic. And in the 90s, I built a company called Internet Global that it was one of the very first internet companies. And streaming video that we're doing right now, we helped develop it, and streaming audio and lots of other things. But when that company sold, I called a bunch of friends and I said, I'm going to climb Kilimanjaro. And some of them would say, well, how do you spell that? Where is it? And so one of my lifelong friends, Dr. Brooks, who was an electrical engineer, medical doctor, he had been working at NASA as a flight surgeon, i.e. taking care of astronauts in space. And he was one of the ones who came with me. And Dr. Brooks, while we were climbing, was constantly telling me, you know, it's not right. I have an electrical engineering degree and a medical degree, and you made more money in one transaction than I'll make in a lifetime. So, you know, during that trek, we decided to start talking about a company we could build. The night before we summited, he was online using my satellite link. Okay, now Kilimanjaro has a cell phone tower. Back then, we had this very clodgy satellite device that I had to figure out exactly where in the sky to point it and pay $5 a minute for communications. And he's sitting in his tent communicating back with Texas. And I said, you know, what are you doing that's so important? And he goes, well, I'm talking to patients. And that's what clicked.
That's where it came from.
Okay.
Eureka.
You can talk to patients. And of course, I didn't realize it sounded like a brilliant idea. If I had realized how many sheriffs would come to my office and say, you're going to prison for doing this, who knows? You know, as entrepreneurs, we have to be risk takers and intrepid, but to have the Drug Enforcement Agency come into your office with M16s is a little bit scary, even for an entrepreneur.
Wow. Can I follow up on that? I haven't read about that story, and so I'd like to know about that.
Well, here's the good news. The history of telemedicine starts in 1968 with a man named Jay Sanders.
And, oh, my goodness. That long ago.
So right here is a book called Digital Medical Home that Jay and I wrote. It's a really short book, and it's essentially the fact history of telemedicine. Funny story, when I decided I wanted to write it, I called Jay and I said, hey, Dr. Sanders, you know, I want to write a book. And he said, Michael, we got to write fast. And I said, why? And he said, I'm 82 years old. I don't buy green bananas anymore.
Yeah.
So we did. We got it written really fast. And in January, so now he's about to turn 89 or 90, I think. Mm. In January, I called him again. I said, hey, let's write a fiction version of that. So... Do you remember the old show Dragnet where the guy comes on?
Yes.
The stories you're about to hear are true, but the names have been changed.
Absolutely.
You know, we were very cautious in writing that book because we didn't want to incriminate any of the states who had crazy ideas in the early days of telemedicine. So now what we've done is we've created a fictionalized version, which will be done in about a week.
Oh, wow.
And so you'll have the opportunity to read. I don't even know the title of the book, but last night we were finishing up the final chapter.
So how did it come about, if you can share, where the DEA was kicking in your door with M16s over telemedicine, which seems like, how could that be a legal problem at all? To me, I don't understand that at all.
Okay, so you have to roll the clock way back. Everybody knows what telemedicine is now. And I would
Yes.
say you can use the term everybody post-COVID because
Right.
we needed separation between patient and doctor. Teladoc started in the summer of 2000. That's when we climbed
Okay.
Kilimanjaro. And when we actually started building the company, a couple of things happened. There were three major pushbacks. One of them was, is it appropriate to practice medicine across state lines? And so I'm in Texas, so we joke around all the time because remind me, which state are you in?
I'm in Texas. I'm in Dallas-Fort Worth area.
Okay, so you and I are both here. And so you'll
Okay.
get this. Do we really want an Oklahoma doctor taking care of us?
Right.
And so
I get it.
that's,
Yeah. Yeah.
we could joke around about that, and the people in Oklahoma can say the same thing about us. But the reality is, medicine is governed by boards of medical examiners. They are little fiefdoms that sit in each state.
Okay.
And they get money from the doctors and they regulate the doctors. And so practicing medicine across state lines is not about our jokes about, what the people in the next state are. It's really more about controlling the flow and being able to punish the doctors in your state for not doing it your way and making them pay the fees to support your board of medical examiner. So that was
Right.
issue number one. We decided we're not going to fight that one because we won't. Issue number two is it appropriate to treat a patient you've never touched? That was the, and the third one was, can you write a prescription for a narcotic if you've done a telemedicine consult? So one, across state lines, two,
Oh,
patients you've
I'm
never
seeing where
touched.
this
And
is headed.
yeah, we said we will only fight one of those battles.
Right.
As a strategist, you have one front. If you create multiple fronts, ask Napoleon, ask Hitler, ask all the people that were happy they lost. They got on too many fronts and lost. We didn't want to do that. We wanted one. And so we said, we believe we can get to the point where we can treat patients we've never touched. The DEA, when they saw us growing, they thought, these guys are writing prescriptions for narcotics. They are an engine for
Wow.
OxyContin. That's what
Wow.
they thought when they broke into our office that day. And they didn't really break in. They just came in, showed their badges, and they were wearing their flak and they were
Yeah.
ready for a battle. But even though, for those of your audience who don't live in Texas, it really is true. A lot of people in Texas have license to carry. But
Yeah.
we weren't we weren't engaged in that activity. And we weren't gonna go up against the DEA. But I think a lot of what they do is about intimidation and scaring people into compliance.
Yeah.
That story actually has a very happy ending. They spent 3 months taking every single file cabinet apart, looking at
Okay.
every digital file, every transaction,
Right.
every prescription. And we built our engine so that our doctors could not write a prescription. Not would
Okay.
not, but could not. The
Okay.
doctors, if there was a prescription, the doctor didn't even call it in. It went into a queue, a nurse would review the queue and then call in the prescriptions. So
Okay.
we had a layer, and ultimately the Drug Enforcement Agency at the very end got to the point where they actually liked Teladoc and they signed up as a customer.
Oh,
So
wow.
it
That's
was a happy
fascinating.
ending to a story that had a lot of hearts moving a lot faster than they were supposed to that day.
I can only imagine. All right. Well, I want to do a little lightning round. We like to do
Okay.
that toward the
All right.
end, and I'll give you some multiple choice questions, and I'd love to get your perspective. So, if you discovered a tachyon tunnel in your backyard tomorrow, what's the first year or place you'd travel to?
So this is great because we talked about forefathers. I'd go back to the very beginning of the first Boston colony and just sneak around and watch my forefather and see what he was really doing.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, that would be a great one. Absolutely. You have to let's pretend that you have to choose one futuristic tech to become reality right now. Faster than light space travel, a cure for all diseases, or a working time machine. Which do you pick? Faster than light travel, cure for all diseases, or working time machine?
Cure for all diseases. I like that one.
Yeah. Agreed. Agreed. There wasn't a right answer, but I think you chose the right one. Which is harder, pitching to venture capitalists or killing off a character you love in a novel?
Oh my gosh. There's a reason why entrepreneurs call venture capitalists vulture capitalists. it's really, really difficult. But boy, if you read Tachyon Tunnel 2, one of my main characters dies. And that was tough. And there's a lot of people that are angry at me for letting her die.
Yeah. Yep. That's got to be. As a physicist, warp drive versus time travel, which do you think is more likely to be achieved one day or first, I should say? Which do you think is easier for us to achieve, warp drive or time travel?
Yeah, we have to accomplish time travel to get to warp drive. So time travel has to happen first.
Right, because of, the speed of light.
Yep.
Yep. You can bring one fictional sci-fi or fantasy character into your real life to help you at one of your companies. Who would it be?
Spock.
Yes. Absolutely. Wouldn't he be a great CTO?
He would.
Oh, that's great. Okay, last question. And there really is no right or wrong to this. Star Trek or Star Wars?
Oh yeah, there is a right. It's definitely Star Trek. Star Wars is a story. It's a great, fun story. Star Trek is a story with real science.
And I do love how, and I'm a Trekkie, I love the optimistic view of humanity that Star Trek has.
That's
true. I love that in our own future, we will eventually unite and not be so divided. I love that feeling. I love that universe. And so I agree. It's different from Star Wars in that respect. Okay. So this has been awesome. This has been a great experience. I really enjoyed having you on the show. You know, you mentioned you have something coming out soon. Which one is that that's about to drop? I forgot.
The fictionalized version of the history of telemedicine.
Yes.
As you know, we're going to test the speed of self-publishing. I'd like to have it done the first week of July.
Okay. Wow. That is quick. And how is, I think, what was it? The Tachyon Tunnel series, the second book, The Declan Empire, it came out recently. How long ago did that come out?
March. I finished it in February. I hired a great publicist named Lynn McGinnis, and she and I worked to get it on the streets. I think it was March 8th or something like that. Okay. And my goal, I've already started creating the notes. I haven't written Tachyon Tunnel 3, but the goal is to have that out in the first part of October.
Wow, that's great. Phenomenal. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I could talk for another hour with you. This has been great. And we'll have to do it again. I'd love to have you back on the show. I really appreciate you coming on.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right. For all you at home, make sure you subscribe if you haven't subscribed to Uncle Nene's Nerdcast. And as I close every show, for the love of God, please stay nerdy.
All right.